Up next is the Admin Admin podcast. Now, normally we would have jumped straight into the intro track and all those sorts of fun things, but we mentioned quite clearly in this recording that Jerry's audio is going to sound loads better because we'd made some changes to the recording process. Unfortunately, we had a bit of a glitch in Jerry's recording process, and so we actually lose a few of his words. It's not a disaster, you can make out what happens, and we definitely know what's happened, we're going to fix it in the future. But I just thought it was worth letting you guys know that we had a slight problem, and we should have it fixed next time, and to apologise to you. So without further ado, here's the Admin Admin podcast.
Welcome to the Admin Admin podcast, episode 61, the podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
And I'm Jerry.
So this week we start on a brand new adventure for the crew of the Admin Admin podcast. And in this show, we'll be talking about a little bit about why we've relaunched and what the relaunch means for you.
We've also talked about home labs and what we do and what equipment we have and how we test things out.
We're going to be talking about the way you name your servers, from how you might name a printer to how you might name cloud instance.
And without further ado,
here we go.
Hello and welcome back. We've got kind of a relaunch this podcast. We've been away for quite a bit of time, so we're kind of come back and relaunch it. So a couple of things what have happened since we last recorded. As you know, Andy really hasn't been on it for a couple of episodes. He's kind of got another job and he's been really busy, so he's kind of stepping back for a bit. But he'll probably be back. He said that if he can schedule it, he'd like to come on, but he definitely will keep on listening. So John is hopefully going to come and step in for a bit.
So yeah, so I've obviously been on a few of these as a guest presenter, and I'm looking forward to this being a slightly more permanent fixture in your podcasting life.
Welcome.
So we're planning to hopefully kind of change the schedule, because we always find it quite hard. Before, we were just trying to record it whenever we wanted, whenever we could. So what we're planning to do now is record it over a month, and then hopefully on the first of the month we will release an episode. So we're going to do one episode a month, so hopefully that'll be 12 a year hopefully, and it basically gives us time in a month to record and then get everything sorted so we can get it released.
We should also have an honorable mention for Dave, who's kindly editing the podcast for us, producing the podcast in fact.
So the other thing as well that you might have noticed is that the audio quality from a certain member of the team may have increased slightly.
Yeah. And that might also speed up the production of the podcast in general. My audio won't have to have so much post-processing done on it. So yeah. New mic and a mic stand thing. Which should make the recordings lovely.
So also what we want to do is we'd like to see what you'd like to have, what you like and what you don't like about the podcast. Give us some ideas. If you can email us at feedback@admin-admin-podcast.co.uk, that would be great. Is this what you like about the podcast, and is there anything you'd like to change? Because it's come a long way since me and Andy started it just over 3.5 years ago. We're going to probably keep the way that we might go to segments. We're not quite sure yet. We're going to record it in one big go and then maybe cut it into segments. But I think people like it how we can just ramble on sometime and see where things go. But I think we're going to keep on doing the whole IT professionals kind of thing, what we've been up to, and if we've got anything interesting to talk about at work or what we've been doing or interesting we've come across, and then chat about it, really.
Sounds good.
So on that, should we get started?
Yes, sounds good. So the first thing I want to talk about is the way you name your servers. Is actually listening to another podcast, the Answers to Happen podcast, and they were talking about why you shouldn't name your servers with application names in it, just to stop hackers, kind of an extra line of defense. And I just wondered what you thought on that, because I find it really difficult, especially when you're dealing with quite a number of servers, that is knowing, especially if you've got multi-site, like if you've got multiple sites which has got SQL servers or Exchange servers on it, if you have to have something like, I don't know, the name of the site, digits of the site, and then like 001 and then 002, it's quite hard to know what that is and remembering it. And then, I mean, and obviously people say about things like naming their servers after characters from Star Wars or something. That's all right if you know how to spell them, because the problem I have is remembering how to spell these things.
Not just if you know how to spell them, if everyone else does.
Yeah.
So I've got an interesting one with that, which is one of the teams that we work with at work. They had a habit of naming all their devices after countries. So all of the networking gear was named after islands in the Pacific or something like that. And when you phone that through to a vendor, say, for example, Cisco, and you say, you know, just picking two countries at random, you know, Czechoslovakia and Israel are offline, and they kind of go, sorry, so the whole country? No, the names of the devices. Oh, right, okay. Of course, that by that point, that's logged in the ticket, and that causes all sorts of problems.
It does make me think of that time when, I think, was it YouTube got brought down by someone doing some routing in Afghanistan? Someone changed a routing table in Afghanistan, and it knocked out YouTube.
That's BGP. So that's a completely different kettle of fish. But yes, I know what you mean.
It was what it reminded me of, though. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, I name servers by function on the grounds that as long as they're not exposed in DNS, you're not advertising them to anyone. So then it's just on documentation. Obviously, if you're working predominantly with an Active Directory environment, obviously all your boxes are listed in your Active Directory. So at that point, you know, I can see the benefit to not naming things with their function. But then again, I've worked on accounts with high levels of security scrutiny, and they've basically said, the fact that you're hiding the function of the server by obscuring the name, if they look at any network traffic, they'll identify what that traffic is.
Mm.
So I guess it depends on your tolerance for risk in your network.
Yeah. You may as well give them friendly names, because why else are names there? You can basically obfuscate the names from public scrutiny or private scrutiny.
Yeah, so I mean, like the main thing that I was thinking of when this topic first came up was actually around things like printers. So that when you deploy a printer, I think Al, you've mentioned that in the past, you know, you deploy a printer, you give it a name, then if you need to move the printer or re-IP it, it's still got the same name. So like ground floor color printer, or, you know, west wing, you know, third floor scanner, you know, by doing that, you know, automatically that's the box you're talking about, that's the function it's got. There's no kind of ambiguity, there's no need to have a complex configuration management database that says, you know, mm-hmm. Oh, you know, A6257 is a printer on the third floor, whereas A6258 is a mail server, you know, in our data hole.
Yeah, because I mean, the thing I like is, as I say earlier, it's like if we've got a multi-site, and like a lot of the sites are the same, so you've got a SQL box on there or a mail box on there or a print server, you know what it's just having everything. It's so much easier. So you know the three digits for the site, then it's the web or something, 01 or whatever, you know, it's so much easier to jump on it. kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but I never really got the idea of naming servers after Star Wars characters and stuff, especially my worst spelling of things.
I name my laptops after fictional spaceships, but there's only ever one. I've only ever got one laptop at a time, so there's no way of getting confused.
My laptop has been called Minilith because the laptop I had before was a big black block, so it was a monolith. And the next one I got was half the size of it, so it became the Minilith. But that's about it.
Also, the other reason why I like using is just having DNS. You haven't got to worry about working out what an IP address is as well, isn't it? It's just if you change your IP address, you haven't got to worry about notifying everybody if everything's working by DNS.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was going to mention coming from the other direction of, cloud. Systems become, magicked into existence and given a fixed DNS name. So box can go away, but the DNS name remains, which is kind of another way of looking at it. And also it's recommended in AWS, for instance, not to rely on IP addresses because they can change at any time, unless you've got an elastic IP, as they're called, that gives you a fixed public IP. The IP of your web server could change, or whatever server you're exposing to the internet. Mm. So at that point, naming becomes important again. And there's also this notion of external DNS and internal DNS. So systems talk on a private network, but they talk to DNS names rather than IP addresses. And I think they're just ephemeral addresses based on their...
Yeah, absolutely. So I was going to mention ephemeral names as well, and the environment, sort of environment you're talking about as well is, you've got a load balancer that sits in place. The load balancer is going to have a public DNS name, but the load balancer internally is then going to be talking to the ephemeral, cloud name for each of those devices. Yeah. And the load balancer is going to be provisioning that traffic based on what it knows the internal as. Mm. So,
I never heard of that before. What does that mean? What is
ephemeral?
Yes,
it just basically means it's only there for as long as it's there. So, say for example, if you have like a naming prefix, for example. So, like you said before, you might have site, location, project, server type. What you'd have at the end is, 5 hex characters or 6 hex characters, or, your server name might just be 32 hex characters.
Okay.
But you then use a configuration management system to push that host name into your load balancer. So your load balancer, which might be, admin podcast.co.uk, that then has behind it 6 servers, and the ephemeral nature of it is, if you and it comes, so there's another term as well which they use, which is evergreen. So if you've got your web service as a cluster of 6 servers and you want to go from application version A to application version B, you would stand up a new set of 6 servers. You would push the new 6 servers into your load balancer and pull the old 6 servers out in one hit, destroy the old servers. So then you've still got your ephemeral names. Your load balancer knows those 6 boxes. If you lose one box, you pull that one out, you build a new one. It's all ephemeral. The host names never stay the same.
I see. That's interesting.
But there's also, fixed DNS host names. Like it's for something like an API endpoint, api.com, always remains, but the machinery behind it could change. Well, not the machinery, the virtual machines, the containers behind it.
Cool. Anything else about DNS names? I think I've...
The only other thing that I'd say is, ultimately, if you want to have some sort of naming convention for your machines, it's always worth making sure that your DHCP service populates your DNS server. Mm-hmm. So that if you do change the IP address of your box, and again, this happens almost automatically in Windows anyway, mm-hmm. Not every home router, so if you're setting up a home lab or something like that, not every home network will have that that home DHCP server, DNS server marry up. So
does DNS Mask do that?
DNS Mask does do that. And in fact, actually, another podcaster that I speak to occasionally, we were talking just recently about Pi-hole, which is pi-hole.org, I think, from memory. That is basically a pretty web front end to DNS Mask. And it can act as a DNS, DHCP server. So you would swap that out from your router's DHCP service. And
I've used DNS Mask in the past. I had a router that didn't do DHCP. So I use a Raspberry Pi with DNS Mask.
All right, fair enough. Makes sense.
Like, talk about routers. Who's got a new router out there?
Yeah, I've got a new router. I'm not actually using it. So the traffic for the, you know, moment isn't going through it, but I've got a Unity Edge Router X. Sounds weird calling it that because I've only ever heard Steve Gibson talk about it, and he calls it an Edge Router because that's how they pronounce it. Not a woodworking tool, it's a bit of a network kit.
So why did you get that router specifically?
What I want to do is just have more control over my home network without having to have a server there. Probably retire my Raspberry Pi, which is doing various network bits as well, or redeploy it. So, and I've got a Unity. Yeah, it's Unity. Wi-Fi.
They made by the same people?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I thought I'd just plug in the cable modem. Fiber. Plug the Edge router into that and plug in the Wi-Fi thing. Take my old router out of the equation.
So for those outside of sort of the UK... fiber to the cab sort of environment.
Yeah.
The when we talk about fiber, we're not talking literally about two glass tubes arriving at your house.
Right.
So in the UK, at least, my experience of it, if you're talking about fiber in a business, then absolutely you're talking about two pieces of glass. For home network provisioning, you're talking about the fiber runs to the nearest cabinet to your house, and about between sort of 3 and probably about 10 years ago, most of the telephony cabinets, which used to be sort of about 2.5-3 foot high, green cabinets about sort of 2 people wide, got replaced with sort of 4 foot high cabinets, which again were about 2 people wide, but whereas before it was like maybe half a foot deep, they're now a good foot deep. That then runs, they've kept the copper connections from those cabinets to your house. But obviously, because the bandwidth capacity to the cabinets is higher, it means that they're splitting out much, much closer to your home. So you now get what they call, I think it's VDSL.
That's it, yeah.
And that's a box that's about the size of, you know, most home DSL routers that is attached to the wall and presents a PPPoE interface to your next hop down, which is typically your DSL router.
So... at the cab, it's a DSLAM, isn't it? They have many DSLAMs in the cabinet. So that's where the fibre goes to the cabinet, isn't it?
Correct.
So yeah. That's got a mini DSAP. So, Jerry, have you got one of the BT OpenReach modems at the moment?
I fished it out of a box in the loft because I got a router that could do both. I thought it would be tidier, but the
router So that's why I've got a MikroTik in. I've got one of those white boxes. So that does the syncing to the VDSL, and then I do a PPoE connection. So that means that because I get a public IP address, a static one, that gets presented as an interface on my MikroTik. So I'm guessing that's hopefully what you can do on the Edge router.
Well, I probably wouldn't be able to get a static IP, but...
It'll basically give you an IP address. Your public IP address should be able to get you on that interface.
Yeah. So then it's what you kind of do. You know, you can do things like SNMP, gathering metrics from the router about traffic that's going across, control internet access by, you know, MAC address, that kind of thing. I was originally looking at this, the LEDE, LEED, or whatever it's called, and apparently you can run that on this hardware, but you couldn't run it on my router, so that was my rationale behind replacing my router, replacing it with something with more functionality.
But I think that box, that Edge3Direct, it comes with like 5 ports in it, is that correct?
Yeah, it's a power over Ethernet as well. It can be powered by power over Ethernet.
And then you can basically, I'm guessing you can have separate VLANs on there, so you can have your own Internet of Things on separate ones, have guest networks.
Yeah, so that'll be fun.
So I know that the box is, from memory, it's running a Linux distribution underneath. I think it might even be based on Debian from memory.
Yeah, I've used the command line. It's very Linuxy.
So if I was to get one of those, can you install services like, for example, OpenVPN or Dan's Guardian or something like that? Can you install those sorts of things in there, or do you not know?
Don't think so. I think you can do that if you put the LEED firmware on it.
Right.
So looking at the specification on the actual data sheet, it says you can do IPsec site-to-site VPNs and remote access.
Oh, okay.
OpenVPN site-to-site, PTP, PPTP, no, and L2TP, remote access.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Apparently you can do Radius client on it as well, DNS forwarding, VRRP. Isn't that virtual router? Is that like where you can have multiple ones?
Yeah, so effectively you would present a single IP address. You'd present an IP address per device, and you'd have a floating IP address between each of your appliances. So VRRP was the protocol, from memory again, is the one that Nokia implemented for their firewall product. It's advertised over a multicast.
I was going to say, was it multicast?
Yeah, so all the members join this multicast group. And again, it's been a while since I've looked at VRRP. But I'm pretty sure it's a multicast that occurs on the interface that is proximate to the... So each interface that's got the VRRP presented on it uses this multicast address on that interface. But it's used only by that collection of devices. So, interesting.
Sounds interesting.
Is that what you plan to do with it then?
Have six of them there just to protect yourself from, you know, not being able to watch Netflix.
Probably not quite that advanced.
No? Okay.
Cool. Another thing, Gigi, what about home labs? Someone's put something about home labs on the...
So I've recently joined a Facebook group called Home Labs. Basically it's people like, well, me, who have got, you know, enough kit there to be able to simulate or develop or test stuff at home. I mean, my home lab, and I put very loose quotes around that because basically it's just a single box running multiple VMs. But some people have got, you know, extensive AV gear. They've got racks full of kit. And colleagues that I've worked with in the past have definitely, you know, their garage has got like three racks and, you know, sort of more Cat 5 than a normal comms room, you know. But these are people that will, you know, they clock off work and then they go home and then they learn on their home kit. So that, you know, it won't necessarily be the latest kit. So it might be, you know, six switches from 10 years ago that can just about do gig, you know, or it might be, you know, a handful of discarded, you know, firewalls, or, you know, a handful of, you know, 2010 vintage servers or something like that. But equally, some people have got, you know, large IoT ranges of gear. And I just wondered, you know, whether either of you guys have got, you know, lab gear at home, or if you basically just run everything through the cloud, or, you know, if you only ever do, you know, labbed stuff at home, or if it, or, you know, or at work.
I just joined up. I just asked to join that group while you're on the phone when we're doing that.
I did it on the train earlier.
Pictures of why people. So at home, I just really does. I've got a micro server, which runs mainly my live servers. But I always worried about using up too much electric, because a lot of these things, if you get this old kit, like old Dell servers, it's really expensive to run at home.
So
normally what I do, this is the thing as well, this is probably what it's something else which I was probably going to say, is about getting the time to actually learn, getting the actual spare time to do this kind of thing, because I have two young children, and with work and something when I'm a scout leader and looking after family, is don't get that much time to get to play, if you know what I mean.
I used to have a lot of kit hanging around, but basically I was politely asked to chuck a lot of it away, and to be honest, I'm glad I did now, because I'd hate to have it all hanging around now.
So actually that dropped me in it this week, because I had previously had a load of kit knocking around as spares for, you know, in case of emergency, you know, open box and retrieve parts. And like you, I was politely requested to not necessarily get rid of it, but just optimize what was there, which I took to mean scrap the lot. So all that I've literally all I've got left is a drawer with hard disks in that I've got no adapters to sort of plug them into anything. So I don't actually know if they've got anything of any interest or use on them. And I should really kind of just sort of stick a drill through them or something so I can get rid of them safely. But my daughter's nursery actually sort of put a thing on Facebook saying, oh, our servers are dead, and, you know, can anyone help? So my wife generously volunteered me to help them out. And I brought the box home and discovered that the machine wouldn't boot at all. So whereas I thought it was, you know, there might be something wrong with Windows that would need fixing, and that, you know, I could maybe figure out how to solve it. No, it was literally, I've got to the point where I was you can test whether a PSU is actually working by shorting two pins on the molded plug. And I got to the point of doing that to actually confirm that the fan was turning, so therefore the power supply is fine. And I was like, okay. So I now have no motherboard to swap out the motherboard. I've got no CPU to swap out the CPU. I've got no RAM to swap out the RAM. I've got a hard disk, but I could just unplug all the hard disks and CD-ROM drives and stuff and still prove that none of that's working. So fortunately, somebody else then offered a machine, so I was able to sort of retrieve it that way. But blimey, I was...
Probably better, because if you'd probably put in a server, then you'd be the people, every time it goes wrong, you'd be the person
Yes.
Very cool.
Yes, absolutely. But from the other end of things, you mentioned before about not really having the time to work on stuff. What I've found myself doing more and more is virtualizing everything. So when I've got a chance to do something, I tend to spin it up on something virtual. So I use Vagrant when I'm working on stuff at home. And I'm just starting to play with spinning stuff up in either AWS or an OpenStack based thing for remote stuff.
DigitalOcean is really good for that. It's probably the cheapest kind of cloud provider going. It's really nice and simple. So that's what I've been using.
Yeah, that's what I say. I've been, if I need to set up a Linux box for a couple of hours or whatever to play, that's what I've been using. And that's like we've been demoing. And also, I get my head around containers at work, and I was like showing people how it worked. It was easier for me to spin up a couple of cloud instances and show them how quickly it was to boot up a couple of cloud images, and then run a couple of commands and showed how you could load balance between different boxes really easily.
I've been using Vagrant. Yeah, I mean, Vagrant with DigitalOcean just seems really simple, because I've been using it with Ansible, obviously, because I love Ansible. And just as simple as writing the Ansible code and putting a Vagrant file in alongside your code. And then you can describe where, the instance type, the region, and it just takes your API token from your environment, and then you've got a box, and you can test if your Ansible code works or not, and play around with it, and then kill it, so it doesn't cost you too much money.
So I've done the same thing with the Vagrant AWS plugin. The only reason I was using that one, to be fair, is because the environment that I was working with had previously been using AWS. So when I went to use a Vagrant plugin, the Vagrant plugin for AWS was the one that I went to. But generally, on the work side of things, we have OpenStack stuff. So whereas I could use DigitalOcean or AWS to spin something up at work, actually we've got a free tier that we can use of this OpenStack thing at work, so that's the one.
It doesn't really matter what it is, as long as you can what these tools do is they talk to the API of the cloud provider and give you the computing power that you ask for programmatically. So that's it could be Azure, it could be Google Cloud, anything. But I think, my reason behind using DigitalOcean is they may not be the best cloud provider, but they are the cheapest. I'm looking at, because I'm going after these Kubernetes contracts. So I'm going to do the Kubernetes the hard way. I'll put that in the show notes. It's a kind of how to do Kubernetes and work and learn how it all works. And the example documentation is all done on Google Cloud, because the guy that wrote it is Kelsey Hightower, who works for Google. But I looked at the pricing, because it mentions how much it will cost for this cluster, and DigitalOcean comes in, I think, less than half as expensive. So I see that as a challenge. So I'm going to make it work in DigitalOcean. Maybe using Terraform, or maybe even just Vagrant. Yeah.
What about, so the other thing which is quite handy for me is that we're a Microsoft partner, we get so much money a month on Azure. And just having that, it's just really handy, because if you want to just try something out for a couple of hours, so it's like just deploying a VM and seeing how it works, and it's really handy. And I mean, the other thing is we've got a whole demo suite, a physical kit, because we put in a lot of hardware. So like this week I've been doing some test upgrades for some Windows services, and because I you know how I like Veeam, is that I can restore within 2 hours. I had my complete infrastructure running in my demo suite. So I had the whole, I had it VLAN'd off so nothing could touch our live network, but I had both my domain controllers back up in my demo suite, and I had my SQL Server box I needed to put in there, and the other application server I needed in there. Yeah, within 2 hours, I'd had a whole thing of how, so I can literally test how I was going to do it live. Mm. I think it's just amazing, yeah, really, how it's so easy to get, and it also means you can test that your backups are working as well. So
yeah, I've been using a vSphere cluster at my day job for just prototyping and stuff, and again using Vagrant. There's a vSphere plugin. I think we discussed it last episode, and that just lets you, again, stick a Vagrant file in your alongside your infrastructure code, and then you can bring up a Vagrant box to test out that your code's working and everything. That's what actually gave me the idea for DigitalOcean. And also, I've just looked, there is an Azure provider for Vagrant as well, so anyone's wondering. What I would say, though, is if you can, put your credentials outside the Vagrant file, because that's just asking for trouble. It's Ruby, so I'll leave it as an exercise for the listener about how to store your credentials outside the Vagrant file.
I might actually have a gist of that now. I'm just having a quick look whilst you're talking.
I did something, you know, which worked, but I think there's a few different ways you can do it.
Yeah, I've I'll stick that in the show notes.
The good thing, again, about using DigitalOcean is that it just works, isn't it? You haven't got to download the ISO. It's just booting up. And it's just there. Mm. You can just SSH into it. And it definitely, again, like you say about how you can...
There's a Mosh plugin. So I don't know if we talked about this before. Mosh is a mobile shell, and it lets you SSH if you've got a dodgy connection. So I've used it on the train quite extensively. And you can just automatically install Mosh and get Vagrant to use Mosh box that you've just brought up, which is great. This is brilliant.
Mm.
It just kind of simplified what I was doing by an order of magnitude, because I was using Terraform to bring a box up in DigitalOcean, which is quite a lot of work, and then storing the manually linking the IP to a host name or something, you know, that side of things. Whereas Vagrant, you just go Vagrant SSH and you're in, or Vagrant Mosh and you're in.
There's also a Vagrant RDP for when you're working on Vagrant from Windows.
Yeah, all right.
If we're talking about Vagrant plugins, I find Vagrant Cashier to be quite a good one for working with local provisioned stuff. So I use that for if you're provisioning lots of the same type of machines. It basically links the var cache or var spool directories, depending on sort of not whatever your application manager packages, wherever they're stored, it links that to another point in your system. Like when you mount slash Vagrant with the Vagrant plugins, it does the same thing.
Oh, right.
It's just shunts.
Is this a Vagrant plugin that helps you reduce the amount of coffee you drink while waiting for boxes to be provisioned by sharing a common package cache among similar VM instances?
Yes, that's the one. Spot on.
Looks interesting.
So that went in a direction I wasn't entirely expecting, but that's all good.
Basically, Vagrant rocks.
It really does.
It's good. I mean, most people use it on their own laptops using VirtualBox, but it's a lot more powerful than that.
So I use a lot of people will use Docker to separate out individual applications. I like using Vagrant to separate out different machines, basically. I separate out stuff that does media playback and things like that from each other, so that I know that if I kill that box, it's killed for all of the devices on the network and those sorts of things. So I separate out things like Logitech Media Server and my Streisand Open VPN and IPsec VPN Terminator using Vagrant.
Right.
I've blown both your heads off with that one, clearly.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think about to think through all the implications of that.
So what I basically do is because under the surface, obviously, these Vagrant boxes are just running VirtualBox for the home network stuff that I do. So you can attach a public network interface to your Vagrant machine.
Yeah.
So I just attach a public, for each box that stands up, it gets a public IP address. So that then means that if it needs to do broadcasts, which is what, Logitech Media Server uses the broadcast address. So that's the last IP address in your subnet. Usually .255 as the last octet. So it has to talk to that to advertise to the network that it's got services sitting there. And again, the Streisand server that I use, I want that to have a public IP address so that I can then port forward all the various ports that it needs to get to that box. But it also, by nature of the fact that the primary interface for that box is a hide address. So it hides behind a NATed address with Vagrant when you run it through VirtualBox. So it means that although it's coming in to a public address or a nominally public address, it then gets rewritten to come out of the on the inside side with the local address that the machine that's running VirtualBox on it.
Right.
So it means that, because whereas before you'd have to kind of go, all right, okay, well, I need to route all of the boxes on my network so that I need to set a static route up so it'll point, you know, I think 10.8.0/24, that needs to go to whatever box it was that was terminating my OpenVPN stuff. Now all that happens is it all comes into this Vagrant machine. It goes out of the VirtualBox interface for, you know, browsing traffic on my local network or going out to the internet. The only thing that actually matters is that the when it talks to the address of the Streisand box, it's from the internet. It's talking to that using a specific address. So it will go back out of the same interface. Anyway, it's network wizardry. We'll call it that and hide.
So it's giving your virtual box, Vagrant boxes, an address on the LAN, mm-hmm. as opposed to being NATed behind the...
Yes.
Okay.
So it comes up with two interfaces. One which is let's say, for sake of argument, my home network's 192.168.10. So I give that an address, 192.168.10.50. And then, so the traffic comes in, the public internet traffic comes into 192.168.10.50. It gets unencapsulated, and then that then tries to talk out using the NAT hide NAT, the VirtualBox NATed address range, which is usually 10 dot something. So it then goes out using that 10 dot address, which means it has to route that out via the 10 dot side.
Right.
Or at least that's the plan. It might not be working like that, but that's how it's working in my head. It works, so I've never really looked at the intricacies of the internals of it, but it certainly seems to work. So,
You haven't got an OpenStack installation on your home network, have you?
No, not yet. So
it's only a matter of time.
So one of the things that was listed at the bottom of this Home Labs thing was what was referred to as the wife acceptance factor or the partner acceptance factor. There is a very low tolerance for wife acceptance factor in this household.
I think we've all three of us probably pushed our luck for far too long.
Yeah.
So, moving on, I was going to mention it's not what you know, it's who you know. So, I've been dealing with a customer who's got some Palo Alto firewalls. I've always quite liked them. I think they might be a bit, they're quite expensive, I think, to purchase. But, I mean, the idea with in my day job is Cisco ASAs. Mainly, and I've been used to use Juniper Nets when I used to be in the Nets screens kind of thing. And I don't mind the ASA, it's just that they sometimes seem to me do things a bit backwards with the rules set, and definitely their NAT side of thing is completely really odd. And their VPN side of things can be very confusing with their phase one and phase two. I've always kind of liked looking at Palo Alto, and I was not brought into the Palo Alto. There's a really techie guy who taught me, who's showing out. So basically I was looking at learning about them, and I was trying to find some VMs of how to get some demo of it. And I was trying to looking at, is it Udem? Whatever it's before. Yeah, Udemy. And like, you could buy videos on there for like if there's a deal, like 5 or 6 videos on there. But the guy was saying, no, you don't need to do that. If you can they actually provide the training free by their website. So you can actually sign up. You haven't got to even be a partner, because I haven't even got a partner ID. And you basically sign up, and there's like 4 or 5 tutorials on there where you can actually follow how to configure them. And you can actually take an exam, which is the ACE exam, which is accredited configuration engineer, to get qualified. But if you want to get properly qualified, which is a Palo Alto certified network security engineer, it's like where you have to go to a test center and get tested. But I was really surprised how it's not what you know, it's who you know to find this information out. So for free, I've now got access. I'll put the link in the show notes so you can go on there and learn all about the this firewall. And you can't play about with them, kind of thing. But I've had a play about with them, and so far, they're quite easy to configure so far. And they've got APIs and the CLI in there to configure them. So
I've been doing something similar to that, but not with the Paolos. So I've been playing with the Fortinet 40 gate boxes.
Are they really hard to configure? Like, there's like the XML file for them. They're like really,
it's no. All web GUI. So sort of. If you are standing up a virtual machine, or if you are trying to do anything to do with licensing, then yes, absolutely, you have to use the web UI for that. You can pull a license file using the command line, which is a bit messy. But actually, so my day job has been Screenos and Checkpoint and Acer's for the last 10 years. And actually, I have found the Fortinet product to be really intuitive. Now, there are some caveats with that, which is I'm not very fond of the SSL VPN side of things. I'm sure it works, but I've also previously used the Pulse Secure, which used to be the Juniper IVE, and before that was called something else. And I really liked that as a product. But for the price point, I think the 40 gate is actually better. And in fact, for a home deployment, they have a access point model that has got the 40OS built into it. So you can deploy an access point that has got all the same feature set as the commercial grade firewall in the form factor of, you know, a Wi-Fi hotspot. So actually, it looks really nice. Now, that's not to say... So obviously, the day job means that I tend to look at sort of carrier grade and enterprise grade pieces of tin. But when I was looking around at what my options were between the Juniper boxes, which they don't do Screenos anymore, it's now Junos, and I've not really got on that well with the Junos kit, but again, that might just be familiarity. And the Checkpoint kit all seems particularly expensive, but it is what they refer to as the gold standard for, you know, firewall products. But actually, when I was looking at the 40 gate, it was very, very good and very, very slick. And in the later releases, so they've just released, I think it's 5.6.3 of the 40OS. It's very nice. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed working with it. And being you, the command line is very, very similar to working with a Cisco box. So, you know, it's configure something or other and then run commands on that bit and then end that and then run configure on something else and then end that. Which you don't really get that with the Checkpoint. You can't really configure very well. You can now, as of R80, you can now configure stuff with Checkpoint from the command line. But it's definitely baked in to the 40 gate box. Not that they're sponsors, because we don't do sponsorship here. But, yeah, it's certainly been an enjoyable experience, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I'll give you an update when I've done some more training on that. I need to get back into that. But there's, like, three exams. There's, like, three courses we recommend doing. Like, cause currently they're doing – their current OS is PanOS 8, but the PanOS 8 configuration isn't that great. So the guy was saying you should do the 7.1 first and then go do the 8 to kind of refresh yourself. But yeah, it's an interesting firewall. So yeah, it's good. So
fair enough.
But this is, again, it's a surprise. It's not what you know, it's who you know to find this information out.
So I'd not worked on 40 gates until I joined this new team. And anyway, I've waffled on enough about my vendor of choice. So
yeah, because I just had in the past where I've seen people say that when you export the config, it's not very user-friendly to edit it and then load it back in again. That was what I've heard from people at work. So, but again, apparently it's got a really good price point as well compared to something like the Paolo. Really expensive.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think we're calling for about 50 minutes now. So last, like any other business, we want to chat before we can let people go onto their next podcast. I found out another show called the sysadminshow.com, which is another podcast. This is happened. I haven't actually listened to it, so I have no idea how good it is or anything. So it's on my list to listen to. But because I was away quite a lot last year, I'm still about 20 hours behind on my podcast listening. So I don't want to add anything more until I've got back up to my back into at least a week's worth of podcasts kind of thing. So just check that out.
I'm currently looking for work in London, so I should get a good, well, probably extra 2 hours a day to listen to podcasts. So I'm actually in the market for more podcasts at the moment.
Well, if you're looking for some more podcasts, then I've actually been listening to a thing called The Darknet Diaries, which is where a guy basically does a show every couple of weeks, I think it is, talking to people who have been involved in perpetrating or being on the receiving end of security incidents. One of the more recent ones, they were talking to a guy who accidentally broke into the wrong bank in, I think it was Beirut, because he was an American guy, and he does red teaming. So he basically runs attacks against a building, and he ran a physical attack against this bank. And it was the bank next door to the one he was supposed to have been attacking. But it's a really good podcast to listen to. They've talked about Bitcoin, their ransomware stuff. They've talked about lots of different bits and pieces.
That was another thing on my show list to talk about, was red team and blue team. But we can talk about that next week or next time.
Next month.
We've got a couple of dates in the diary, haven't we, coming up as well. So BuzzTalk Live, 9th of June, came out on Twitter the other day. I guess there's some more info come out.
So that's that there's information about that at fosstalk.com. So that's fosstalk.com. And that's a night of live entertainment from a handful of podcasts, such as the Ubuntu podcast and Late Night Linux.
And some special guests sometime from other podcasters.
So the other one that is on the calendar is OgCamp, which is on the 18th and 19th of August, and it's going to be in Sheffield this year. At least a couple of us are hoping to be there. But
I'm hoping to stay there the whole time.
Coincidentally, I'm one of the organisers, so if I'm not there the whole time, something's gone significantly wrong.
So we're coming to the end of the show. So again, thanks for listening. We just want to say about, give us some feedback, feedback@admin.co.uk. Just want to know what you like about this show, or what you don't like about the show, and what you'd like to see the show going forward. Also, I'd really like to, if you could spread the word of the podcast, really, trying to get it now relaunched it, kind of get it back out there, really.
So that means if you are an avid Facebook user, or if you like to tell the world what you've had for breakfast on Twitter, please feel free to also mention about the Admin podcast. Tell your friends, and if you want to talk to us, we have a Telegram channel, which you can find all of these links on the Admin podcast website. And we also have a Patreon. So if you want to support the show, there's no obligation for you to do so, but anything that you can give absolutely helps us. Just puts a little bit towards the running of the show.
At the moment, the co-host, well, one of the co-hosts and the editor are the only Patreons, so please feel free to just swell the numbers a bit.
Yes. So, get the word out there. Check our website out to find those links, and we'll speak to you in a month's time.
We will indeed.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
See you next time.